again, and welcome to lecture six of the GR course. Before I get going, a couple of things about notes and things. One is that thank you for those who filled in things about the EVASYS things. Some very useful feedback there. One of the things that was mentioned was, which I think it's fairly easy to do something about, audibility. And I think the room is against us there, because there's quite a low ceiling here of soft material, fabric at the back. So there's not a, and also there's, I think, because of a shelf there, a bit of a poor impedance match. So I think it is quite possible that I'm yelling down there, you can't necessarily hear me very well here. So I shall aim to project, but if I'm failing at the back, just shout out volume or something. Just yell. I think we can handle that. Now, another thing that was mentioned was the issue of just the volume of stuff. And I have a slight, and how one navigates around those. And so I'll recap a bit and remind you that at the beginning of each chapter, the aims and the objectives. The aims are the high-level things, the point. The objectives are the things which are also useful but are less exciting but are accessible, in the sense that they are things which you can I can ask you to do in an exam. And those structure, you should have those in mind when reading through, reprocessing the notes after the lecture. If you look at the exercises at the back of the chapters, a lot of those are keyed to fairly specific objectives. So you can see, oh, this exercise is in the service of that objective, and look through things with that in mind. Another issue is that it's sometimes difficult to... It is a defect of the notes that there's a lot of it. Sometimes a little hard to see what the key thing is. So what I spent some time last weekend doing is adding to the notes some sort of key points in selected sections. And in the slides that you'll see now, at the end of various sections, there's a point of just the highlights of that. Now, having said that, I'd encourage you not to look at those, because I encourage you to go and look at and do the same exercise for yourself. Because picking a section and going, what am I supposed to be getting out of this, and writing that down is by itself a very useful exercise. Because standing back a bit and saying, what was the point of that, I get it, is a useful exercise. But you see my version there as well in the slides. I've also decided to put the slides up ahead of time rather than behind. There's essentially nothing in the slides that that isn't in the notes. But it might be, depending on how you want to use, what you want to scribble on, you may want to use that. And I've also put up the, as I said in the Moodle posting, I've also put up the compendium of all the exercises. Usual thing, it's not useful to do these, to look at the answers too quickly, but you're honour students now, you know that, and you can do what you like with those. You can undermine yourself if you want, I'm sure you won't. I put that up just to remind me that those things are there. Not entirely obvious. You have to click on that tiny little arrow to see the contents. I rearranged it a bit just to make it look less huge. There are just basically three sets of things in there, but in a couple of different formats. Any questions? Okay. There were other useful points in the feedback, which I will mull over and think of at various points. So that's not the only feedback. Other things that you can think of to say, mail me. It's all good. Okay, where we got to last time was the end of section of 3.1. We're just encroaching on the bit about Gwin differentiation when we basically ran out of time. So if I can find my slides, view, full screen mode. We got but as far as they so there's a you know, one of those key point things that what I thought was the key point from that section. So what I'm going to do this time is talk about how we do differentiation in a case where basis vectors that we're using to create our coordinates, where they are changing over the space. We're first going to do that in flat space, and then we're going to do it in curved space. And the surprising thing is that second step turns out to be the easier of the two. You think it was the other way around. So you have done this. This is, to some extent, another case where you've done this before, but not in this notation. So there's that slight notational issue, and there's also a slight stepping back and seeing what it was you did before. Because what you did before was things like, you've seen the Laplacian in spherical polars. Bit of a mess, but it's a bit of a mess because the r, theta, and phi basis vectors are changing as you move over the space. And so when you differentiate the components of a vector in those coordinates, you have to do all sorts of stuff to get the coordinate independent change in this vector as it moves around the space. So this is about differentiating a vector field. You've got a vector field of, for example, the electromagnetic field, and you're asking how does that change as I move around the space? And the Laplacian is part of the answer. If we simplify things a bit and talk instead just of plane polar coordinates, let's start off simple and work up. So the plane polar coordinates are near projected source camera. Not that far. Plane polar coordinates are E R and E theta. And we want to ask, and those are derived from the basis vectors, the Cartesian basis vectors. ER is cos theta. I'm copying this down just to get the signs right. EX plus sine theta EY. And E theta is equal to minus R sine theta EX plus R cos theta EY. Now, aha, but you may say, I don't remember that R being there. You don't. That's because the basis vectors of the plane polar basis vectors you're used to are orthonormal vectors, where specifically the R is removed in order that these both be squared. However, this is, in some sense, the more natural one without that correction. We can go into why that is, but that R is there deliberately and inconsequentially. It doesn't really matter how I define my basis vectors. Just in this case, these ones are orthogonal but not orthonormal, for reasons which we can talk about if need be. Now, we want to ask, how do these change as we move around the space? And that's not hard. We do things. We can say d by dr of E R is ER doesn't vary. It doesn't depend on R at all. D by d theta. Is this on or something? Why is there a funny echo? I'm not sure if it's just close space. Anyway, d by d theta of ER is going to be it's going to be minus cos theta E X plus sine theta E Y.
The other way.
Well, thank you. Minus sine theta E X plus cos theta E Y, which is just 1 over R E theta, and so on. So we can just work through those four possibilities, differentiating the radial and tangential basis vectors with respect to R and theta, and get expressions which are the remaining two are d by d r e theta equals 1 over r e theta, and d by d theta e theta is equal to minus r e r. And one of the reasons why orthonormal coordinates are good is because you avoid these extra factors of r. So, no surprises there. Now, what happens if we pick a vector, v, and ask, how does that change as we move around, as we move radially? So as you move away from the origin, how does the vector v change? That's e by dr of v r e r plus v theta e theta, which is dvr by drer plus vr der by dr plus and so on. And notice, by the way, that I'm slipping in a notation here that I'll use occasionally. I'm indexing the basis vector and the component with the symbol r rather than an index 1, 2, 3. So that's sort of a slightly slangy way of indexing the r component and the theta component of the basis vector. I'll put that on that slide as well. Okay. Or we can just write that in a sort of in index notation as d v I by d r e I plus v I d e I by d r. And a question.
Why do we differentiate with respect to r? Like
in this case, because it could be r or theta. So what we can do is maybe more generic in exactly the way I think you suggest, and say dv by dxi is going to be dv, j, dvi by dxj ei plus vi de I by dxj. Yeah. So is that what you meant? Yeah. So, I could have written that down from the outset. I mean, I'm just sort of easing us into that expression from here. We could have just written that down. Okay. But notice that's a vector. We're asking, how does that vector change as you move around? And if the vector starts off here in this position and here in this position, then there's a change in that vector. So that change in the vector is a vector, which is a number times a vector, a number times a vector. In other words, this dei by dxj is, not entirely surprisingly, also a vector. Which vector is it? If it's a vector, then we can express that vector in terms of the basis vectors. So if we write dei by dxj, it's some components multiplying the basis vectors, and we write the components gamma k j I. I think I've written IG. Sorry, IG. And gamma here is called the Christoffel symbol or Christoffel symbols. No one seems to be quite clear whether it's symbol or symbols. The Christoffel symbols are nothing more than nothing more than the components of that vector in that basis.
Is that basis EK the same as EI?
Yes, it is. So we're just we're picking a different index. So it's the same set of basis vectors. So this is a vector in that space, and so we're saying if it's a vector in that space, then it's expressible in terms of the basis vectors in that space. And we could also have just written that down from scratch. I mean, there's nothing was stopping us doing that, but this is all motivating. This is a gamma. Say again?
It represents a number.
It's a number, yes. So this is a number,
so
exactly. It's a set of n by n by n numbers. Okay?
So the left is a vector and the right is a number and a basis.
A basis vector, yeah. Yeah. So this isn't a tensor. It's not the components of a geometrical thing. It's just a set of n by n by n numbers. So we can write. So if we go back a bit and ask dE r by d theta, I wrote. We might write that dE e one by dx two, calling r x one and theta sort of, and theta equals x two. That will be gamma 1, 1, 2, E1 plus gamma 2, 1, 2, E2. I'm just illustrating what the what that sum looks like. And from above, and we could look back a page, discover that the D ER by d theta is 0 times E1 ER plus 1 over R E2. In other words, gamma 1, 2 is equal to 0. Gamma 2, 1, 2 is equal to 1 over R. And that's how we calculate what these Christoffel symbols are for a particular set of basis vectors. It's a turning the handle thing. A bit tedious, but it's the sort of thing it's very easy to test, like very easy to do. And several of the question of the exercises encourage you to just turn that handle. There are no thrills in turning that handle. It's just a matter of practicing doing so and not getting lost. Okay. So that that means that for plane polars, gamma 1, 1, 2 is 0, gamma 2, 1, 2 is the same as gamma 2, 2, 1, and gamma 1, 2, 2 is equal to minus R. And we'll also write that sometimes as gamma R theta equals 0, gamma theta r theta equals gamma theta theta r equals 1 over r, and gamma r theta theta equals minus r. This is a slightly slangy notation, which I hope is clear. But by r, I mean these are supposed to match up. So does that mean, so any questions on that? That's mostly another notational section, telling you something. Again, the idea is this is telling something you do know, but in different notation. But it allows us to define the covariant derivative, because what we have, if we go back a bit, we have dv by dxj is equal to dvi by dxje I plus v dEi by dxj. But we know that that is equal to gamma kijek. And so if then we decide to relabel that as dvi by dxjei, and instead of i's write k's, instead of k's write i's, so vk gamma ikjei. No, all I've done there is these repeated indexes are dummy indexes, the I and the K, so they can be anything. So I've decided to rewrite them simply with different letters. That's an entirely equivalent expression, but what it means is I can take this EI out of there and get DVI by DXJ plus EK gamma IKJEI. And discover that, so what we have there is this is a vector with components that. And I'm going to write those components in a particular way. I'm going to write those components as VI semicolon JEI equal to VI comma J plus VK gamma IKJEI, where this notation VI semicolon subscript semicolon J refers specifically to that expression, and the notation I've just introduced there, VI comma J, refers to the plain usual derivative of dVi by dxj. So that's dVi by dxj, like that. That's the last notational bad surprise, okay? Punctuation in subscripts. I'm sorry, I didn't make it up. Semicolon j is a little tricky to write neatly, I agree. My handwriting improved massively when I started doing this. Now, I have a quick question here. That's an illustration of that. That's that. so the key points of the previous section were that the basis vectors vary over the space. We knew that. And that variation can be characterized using this notation, using the Christoffel symbols. So, a quick question. What sort of thing is the term in brackets in the expression, in that expression? Who would say it was a scalar? Who would say it was a vector? Who would say it was a one-form? A tensor? A matrix? Have a brief chat about it. Okay, with that reflection in mind, who would say that was a scalar? Okay, a vector, one form, tensor, a matrix. Two of those answers sort of are correct. In one sense, yes, this is a scalar, because it's the pick an I and K, and yes, there's a number which corresponds to this. So yes, but at the same time, for a reason which I'm about to elaborate on, this turns out to be a tensor as well, because or the components of a tensor, because what we have here is a thing which linearly depends on the right. I'm going to go through this next thing in the way I expressed it in my notes, because rather than busk a possibly confusing answer, because it is. The key thing is that this vector here is proportional to the basis vector EJ. If you made EJ twice as big, you make all the components half the size, and that vector would change inside accordingly. So there's a proportional relationship between those things. So this is a thing which depends on the variation of V around the plane, and the size of the linearly depends on the size of the vector, which corresponds d by dxj, which is the basis vector. So what we can do is we can define a 1-1 tensor nabla V, and we'll define that by saying that the action of that on the vector E, how do I call it, EJ, so the 1-1 tensor, so it takes a vector argument and a one-form argument, and the action of it on there, right? I'm going to write it in a way, other way around, in a way to just make sure it's consistent with my notes. Just the distinction isn't important, but the action of that 1-1 tensor when we give it one vector as argument, one basis vector as argument, is dv by dxj as a vector. So we're saying, let there be a tensor which is related to v, which we're going to call the covariant derivative tensor. And our definition of that tensor is through the slightly indirect way. Remember that the tensors, a 1-1 tensor, takes a one-form and a vector as argument. And if we give as the vector argument to that covariant tensor, I'll get a moment, if we give as the vector argument to that tensor one of the basis vectors, then by fiat we say the v of that tensor is this vector here. And being a vector is something which takes a one-form as argument. So there's a missing one-form argument in both places. I think the acoustics in this room are not good.
Why is he proportional to xj and not ei?
Right. We could pick any basis vector here. So we've said, if you remember, the basis vectors are ei equal to d by dxi. So we'll just pick a random basis vector, in this case EJ. And so we're saying, if we apply EJ, could be anyone, picked EJ, then we get the derivative of that vector V with respect to the corresponding coordinate function. Okay, right. So what we have here then, now that's As I've said, this notation with the dots and missing arguments is slightly unconventional. There isn't really a completely conventional way of writing these, but one conventional way of writing these is to write that as nabla e j v, where we write this vector argument as a subscript there. And we write this sufficiently often that, of course, we want to abbreviate it, so we end up writing nabla j v. And that is intended to be a short version of that, and that is just means that. It means that this tensor nabla v with one argument filled in a slightly funny place, written down in a slightly funny place. So we have a tensor nabla v. We want to ask stepping back a bit, what are the components I, j of that tensor? What we do is we nabla v and fill in omega I e j. But we know that that is also written as nabla e j v, and the ith component of that by filling in the by filling in this omega I, we're extracting the ith component of this vector here So we're getting the ith component of this nabla v ej, which we also write as nabla I v j I, and in particular by comparing it with on the previous sheet, that is v I semicolon j. So it's important to look at to be clear what we're looking at, the various stages here. So nabla v is a tensor. We're asking, what are the IGA components of that tensor? How do we do that? We plug in omega I and EJ into the two one-form and vector arguments of that thing. But we know what that is. We just notationally change that thing there to this. The omega I is extracting the ith component of the result, so it's the ith component of this vector. Because this by now is a vector. We rewrite that as for convenience, not nabla ej but just nabla j, and we know from this that the other way we write that is with this vi semicolon j, which expands to this. So there's quite a lot packed into that line. We'll take a couple of goes through it, but I think it's important that you understand what different things are happening in each of those equal signs. So make sure that you have a story in your mind for what that equal sign is doing, that equal sign is doing, that equal sign is doing, and that equal sign is doing. A question? It's a semicolon at the end, yes.
Yeah, what the meaning of
that? Oh, that semicolon is... do I have this? Yeah. This semicolon, VI semicolon J, is this expression here. So it's VI comma J, where we've introduced the notation I comma J is just that. It's the derivative of the I component of the vector with respect to to xj. Nothing covariant, just that straightforward thing, plus the other term. So that's and that is the components of the 1-1 tensor, which is nabla v.
How is it the 1-1 tensor if you occupy the vector space, the vector position?
With both of those empty, there's a one-format and a vector thing. If we fill one in, then that thing there becomes a vector, because that thing has a single one-form argument.
So shouldn't it be a zero?
So that is a zero-one tensor. That is a. It's a one-zero tensor. It takes a single one-form as argument. So that takes a one-form as argument.
Yeah.
That takes a one-form and a vector as argument.
So the tensor. That thing is 1, 1, but the whole thing is 1, 0.
Once we fill in one of its arguments, then what we're left with is one unfilled argument, and therefore it's a vector. So remember that if you have a 1, 1 tensor, it's something which takes one vector, one form, and one vector as argument. So sitting there with two holes at the top, ready to have things dropped in, handle turned, a number come out. If we put something into one of those holes, there's only one hole left over. In this case, this thing here, nabla v, is a thing with two holes at the top. It had a one form and a vector hole. Boom, boom. But we have filled one of those holes. So what we're left overall is a thing with one form hole open, as it were. In other words, a vector. Which vector? We're saying it's this vector. And I'm carefully writing here the argument of this vector. It being a vector, it has a single one-form hole. Okay? So we've sort of reversed into this definition of what the tensor is. We've said there shall be a tensor.
A tensor with two slots,
yes. A one-form and a vector.
But the one-form is empty.
It's empty, yes. In other words, this thing here is a vector. This thing here is a vector, which we've illustrated by showing that there's a single one-form shaped slot which can be filled in. And we know what that is. And so this whole business here is doing a bit of a notational dance to discover what the components of this tensor, this 1-1 tensor, it corresponds to this thing that we worked out earlier. Okay, that might need going back through again, a bit of digestion. You will have a little epiphany. Well, it's not the sort of thing that you can sit back in the bath and think your way through. But I think you have to just stare at it for a while and get some illumination that way.
So, just to clarify the notation.
Yeah.
So, if you ever give us a nabla,
yeah,
then something after the nabla, and then you either superscript or subscript something, that means that you have added a basis something onto the thing that comes after the nabla. If that makes sense.
I know where you're going, but I think that in this case, you should think of that. I think here, nabla isn't really being an operator. I mean, it's obviously an operator and it isn't. But in this case, there isn't a nabla operator that acts on things. We ask, what is the covariant derivative of V? How can we talk about how V changes as we move around the space? Then there's a tensor. Then we've said there's a tensor which gives that answer. We could call it Q. We could call it omega. We could call it anything we like. But the name we give it is a two-character name, if you like. It's nabla V.
Okay, so I can have like a one-form that's nabla alpha one-form. Because I have added one form.
We're going to come to the covariant derivatives of one forms momently, but I think right now the useful thing to think about is not to think of this as an operator. This is a two-symbol name for the tensor, which corresponds to V, which is which describes how that tensor varies, how that vector varies, that vector field varies as you move around the space. So I think the next bit might answer your question, I think. Okay, this is moving less quickly than I rather had hoped. But another thing that you might see if you ask specifically a notation like nabla x, nabla subscript x of v, what does that mean? It means, as we can see here, this tensor nabla v with this x argument. X is a vector, is an component xi ei, so that is going to be xi nabla v tilde ei, which is xi vi semicolon j e g. So is x I v j semicolon I e j. And what I've done there, so here, this tensor, what the Cayley is, its vector argument is written conventionally as a subscript. In other words, it's the vector argument being supplied to this 1-1 tensor. It's linear in each argument, so we can take the xi out and have this. But we know what to do with that. You turn the handle here, and we get xi v j semicolon I e j. So this is the covariant derivative of v with argument x rather than one of the basis vectors. Is asking how does the what this is doing is essentially asking how does the vector field v vary as you move in the ej direction. This is asking how does the vector field vary as you move in a more general different direction. So we started off talking about this in component terms. That's just a slightly more general remark based on that. I want to get to the end of this section. So what we've done is we managed to define a tensor field associated with V. So V is a vector field. It takes a different value at each point in the space. We've managed to define a tensor field, in other words, a 1-1 tensor, which takes a different value at different points in the space. We've called that tensor field the covariant derivative. And we've defined it in such a way that the answer it gives us when we put in its two arguments is the amount, the speed at which the vector field v varies at that point in the space. Remember, vectors, you put in a vector, tensors, you put in a vector in a one form and you get a number out. In this case, the answer to the question when you put these two things in is how fast, it's what's the ith component of the variation of v as you change x, j. So, when I talked at the beginning about this idea that a vector was a tensor was a real valued function of vectors and one forms, this is the sort of thing is the thing I'm saying. A tensor is the you put vectors one form in, turn the handle, and out comes a number, an answer. In this case, that's what the answer is. Now we can also, in the last 5 minutes, the point of a covariant derivative is that it's coordinate independent. We've described this using arbitrary coordinates, but the answer is not a coordinate dependent thing. That's the point of that's the point of all this. We're able to answer the question: how does v vary in a coordinate independent way? But if you remember, if we had a function that's a scalar field, then when we obtained the gradient of that scalar field, we got a one-form answer, which was also, because a scalar is coordinate independent, which is also the thing also here is coordinate independent. So for functions, the covariant derivative of a function is just that, ends up being just that gradient operator we've seen before. And I'm not going to go through. I invite you to look at equation, the discussion, just don't really have time to go through in detail, equations 324, 25, 26, where we discover that the covariant derivative of one form is pi semicolon j is equal to pi comma j minus gamma kijpk, which looks just like the expression for the covariant derivative components of the covariant derivative of a vector, except there's a minus sign where there's a plus sign for the vector. And there's a quick derivation of that there, which I'm not going to expend effort on. And similarly with the covariant derivative of sensors of higher rank, you end up with one plus and one minus sign for each of the one form and vector argument, as I mentioned, I think, on the next page. The last thing to remark is that the Leibniz rule does apply. We'll occasionally make use of this pk, vk. That's the covariant derivative of a vector, of a scalar, which is a contraction of those things. And this does end up being indeed pk semicolon j vk plus pk vk semicolon j. That's just the Leibniz rule. In that case, and I mentioned that just to reassure you that still is the case. It would be a strange and disturbing derivative operator which didn't, where that wasn't true. So the key thing here, I think, blah blah blah, not time for that, meditating on why the word covariant is used is useful. Wish I had more time for this. That's the point. When we take the covariant derivative of a higher rank tensor, we get one plus and one minus for each of the of the indexes. I think it is useful to just quickly go through these key points, because we've covered a lot in this section. It is a bit of a hairdryer lecture, this one, which is quite disturbing. But there are. All the time, the question being answered had been a fairly straightforward one. Given a vector field, how does it vary? How can you talk about how it varies as you move around the space in a coordinate independent way? We'll talk about how that's defined, what the components of that. We'll talk about how that. And there is a tensor, a one-one tensor, which gives you the answer to that question. The question then comes: how do we find the components of that tensor? The ij components of that tensor, we discovered by slightly sort of reversing into it that we could do that by simply considering the steps involved in differentiating the components and then the basis vector of a vector. We had this rather strange notation with the semicolons, discovered the covariant derivatives of vectors, of scalars and one forms, to be some of the things we had sort of seen before. And although I had rather hoped to get on to the next section, I have managed to get through this section without a rebellion on your part. So we'll get on to the next section.